Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Peranum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. I am in Austin for the Moon Tower Comedy and Oddities Festival, and over in LA, in our studio, ready to talk film, TV, music, and everything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist, Margaret Wappler.
Hi there.
Hello. And because Oliver Wang is journeying in the outer darkness at some conference, we welcome back USC professor of English and Gender Studies, an unofficial fifth Beatle of Pop Rocket, Karen Thompson.
Thank you. Hello again.
So lovely to have you back, Karen.
It's nice to be back here, looking at your face on the giant screen.
Technology is amazing. Every week we start at the show by taking a question from the listeners about our own pop culture taste. This week I'm going to go around the studio and have each of you tell me, are you a pop culture traitor to your generation in any particular way? I.e., something much beloved by your peers to the point of near consensus that you're just not into. Winter.
Barbies.
Oh, really? Why?
I just found them so ridiculous to spend that much time on supplying a product with something that's never going to really give anything back to you. Barbie didn't really give anything back to you. I knew at an early age it was projecting something, and I think that's why I was so obsessed with video games, because the dynamic would change and then I would be rewarded. There was no reward with Barbies.
As a little girl, did the fundamental black doll hair problem bother you?
100%. I didn't have hair like that. So then I became obsessed about having hair like that, but then I realized it was totally ridiculous. Like, I don't even care about this doll this much to want to look like it. I'm me. But I just didn't care about the doll. I didn't care about the idea that you had to get all these clothes for somebody that's not real.
For the record, no one has hair like Barbie.
No.
And no one has boobs like Barbie or a waist like Barbie or really anything.
You can buy that, though, now.
That's true.
That's true.
I think I was obsessed with them, though, as a kid, because my parents would not buy me Barbies.
Interesting.
I could only get the generic ones because they were just
whose legs would pop out?
Yeah.
And so every time I went over to a little girl's house and she had Barbies, I was like obsessed and didn't even want to talk to her.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't Karen. Into Barbies because, you know, I was a budding homosexual. And I thought dolls were, well, they were creepy to me. I didn't, you know, and I preferred playing with fire trucks and stuff like
yeah.
that. Which, you know.
Yeah.
You would have done well in my house where I had four older brothers and
you
I got all
had
of
so
their
much
fire
fun.
Trucks to play.
We probably would have fought. Me and Karen would have fought them more because we wanted to play the stuff that they were loved the most.
Exactly.
It's truth.
I was obsessed with Barbie, but my parents wouldn't let me because I was a boy. So they would give me Kens because that worked somehow in their head.
Oh my God!
Ken doesn't satisfy anything or anyone.
Exactly.
Prepared you for a life in West Hollywood.
Damn you, Karen. Karen, how are you a cultural traitor?
Actually, I am not, even though I'm part of Generation X or the latter part of that, I never got into, I don't want to call it grunge or alternative music, but, you know, I never got into that whole kind of, I never got into Nirvana, actually, and the legend of Kurt Cobain, which I know we might get into a little bit later, largely because, you know, when I started college, I was coming into consciousness around my sort of ethnic woman sensibilities and also starting to kind of figure out how to come out about my sexuality. So I was super into listening to music that reflected that part of my life. And you know, so I was more into kind of women's music, Katie Lang, Melissa
Women
Etheridge,
with a Y.
Women with a Y. A little less into Ani DiFranco because she was always a little bit shadily bisexual. You know, it was kind of my lesbian fundamentalism phase in music. So that meant, and I did get into Riot Girl and I did get into their critiques of that kind of manarchist punk scene in the Pacific Northwest. I always veered on the side of Courtney, especially when they were in the throes of their comp as a couple.
Oh,
so I was super, super not into actually kind of male alternative or let's call it grunge music from the Pacific Northwest.
Just dominated that scene.
Karen, just promise me that you'll entitle your third volume of poetry In the Throes of Their Comp.
No, I just said that it was the lady bands weren't as dominant in that era.
Well, it was certainly so didn't get radio play.
No.
At
no,
all. Yeah.
No.
Well, there was that shining moment in the 90s where kind of you were hearing a lot of sort of R&B groups like
Alanis,
but there was also En Vogue and yeah. Salt-N-Pepa. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the charts from around that time, that's a lot of the music that was at the top of the charts. And so I was kind of into that during my sort of ethnic woman awakening phase, like wearing dashikis and puka shells and whatever.
Oh, I want a picture.
Karen, I do too.
Oh, there are photographs.
This needs to be on the Facebook group.
Margaret, how are you a generational traitor?
Well, you're probably all going to hate me when I say this, as well as all of our listeners, but Star Wars, I just don't care. I just, especially at this stage in the game, I just don't have any feelings left to feel
I'm
about
with
Star
you.
Wars.
Have you seen all of them?
No. I mean, I've only seen the ones that I was properly young for and could actually get giddy about. I mean, I loved it as a little kid. But I think once, like, that movie came out with Natalie Portman in her, mm-hmm. in her costume and all of that, I checked out. And I've checked out permanently, really. I mean, I watched the trailer the other day for the new J.J. Abrams one coming up. And, you know, I mean, I get it. It looks cool. Like, it definitely, I felt a little bit of the fire. And when Harrison Ford shows up at the end, it's, yeah, I got excited. But at the same time, I'm just like, can't there be new ideas, new movies?
They're in new... it's stars and there's wars. That limits a lot of the sort of the narrative at that point.
A lot of people will get mad at me for this. A lot of personal friends will get mad at me for this. But I think it is fundamentally shallow sci-fi. It's not like there's a particularly big idea behind that sci-fi.
I agree. I mean, one of my favorite critiques ever of Star Wars was from the Chicago Reader movie critic, this guy named Jonathan Rosenbaum, who's just the crabbiest crab of all movie critics ever. And he wrote this review of Star Wars when it got re-released, like in the late 90s or whatever it was. Like, he wrote this review basically saying that these movies, like, glorify war in a sense. They glorify kind of superpowers. Like, there's no kind of deeper critique that it ever goes to, except for like, ooh, look at big spaceships.
It's called Star Wars.
Yeah. And it's archetypal good and evil, you know. I mean, and there isn't a lot of sort of moral subtlety even.
Right.
Well, I mean, the Natalie Portman movies tried to make it a kid's movie, but also tried to make it like deeper than it ever really was.
That's franchise Viagra.
Yeah, it's true.
It was just tiring.
Yeah.
Okay, so you guys are with me. I was expecting to, like, fight to the death about
this.
No,
girl.
Okay.
All in.
Okay. I was going to say Nirvana for mine. Like, I was hardcore going to say Nirvana.
Oh, guys, what?
But since Karen has stolen that, I'm going to go to, like, the other end of my acceptable definition of generation and say, for someone who really, really loves pop music, I never liked Britney. Like, with the exception of Toxic, which I had a very beautiful and significant moment with in a gay bar in San Francisco, like, I just never thought that she was giving me pop at the level, like, that Christina was giving me, or the Spice Girls.
Well, I will say that Toxic truly is the pinnacle of her career. I mean, yeah. That's the best song she ever released.
I don't know how I feel I don't know. About that.
Yeah. I feel good about it.
Blackout is one of the best albums. The Blackout album is one of the best albums that anybody could make in the throes of complete psychological breakdown. I mean, the songs are amazing. I think that's her best album.
I mean, I'm sure
classic Britney too. I mean, all the Max Martin stuff, Hit Me Baby One More Time. You know, Ann Powers actually gave an amazing talk about Britney Spears' icon, cyborg of the 90s, mm-hmm. This last weekend at EMP PopCon, which Oliver talked about last week. And I think you would be flipped by Ann Powers' argument, Guy. So when her book comes out, I'm going to gift that to you. Because
I want a copy too.
True, like,
that would be lovely.
Ann Powers does have a way of flipping things. It's true.
But I'm sure, Karen, you will make the argument that as a gay man, it is my obligation to love vulnerable, broken performers who are giving me everything that they have. But I love a creature in control of herself. I love a woman who I feel like there are ideas behind what she's doing. And Britney just always felt like a tool of the man to me.
Well, a diva like Judy Garland was always self-possessed, even if she totally was a shit show in private or backstage, mm-hmm. whereas Britney actually allowed herself to unravel and, you know, be filmed on a cell phone eating, you know, curly fries nonstop and stuff like that.
Which so, I love that that's
which
like,
was
yeah,
amazing.
Unraveling. Oh, my God, she's eating yeah. curly fries.
When she first had a zit, when they first showed a picture of her with a zit in, like, one of the rags, it was, like, one of the... That picture to them was the signaling the beginning of the end. That's when the tide turned, when she just started stopped giving a natural fuck about things. So I can see why you don't like her, because she sort of lost her point of she lost her point of view
but
probably too early for you.
Get more interesting when she freaked out when she shaved
yeah.
her head.
I don't like her music. I think can be lackluster. Her beating up cars with an umbrella, I think, is magnificent. Like, she's an unquestioned diva of OK Magazine.
Oh, unquestionable, to the point yeah. that they've sort of pushed her to the side at this point. But I'd love to take a revisit down Britney Lane. She's interesting. I can see why you've lost the passion, though.
Maybe she's got more in her. Thanks to Katie Watson in the Facebook group for that question. Coming up on this week's show, Ben Affleck's family history leaked this week, and we all got to feel outraged. Yay. That's what we love. Amy Pascal's Amazon history also leaked, and we got off our high horses to have a good snoop. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. So over this week, for instance, I have been all about this dude from Canada who... basically fabricated a video game story and everybody ran with it. Like Reddit verified him and then blogs started picking it up. And I just love, he basically said that a much beloved franchise from like a really, really good developer, Conker, was not going to be like rebooted. Like there were plans for a reboot that had been announced and it was not going to be rebooted. And it basically wasn't that hard for him to fabricate the truth and for this machine, like that the internet is a gigantic machine for repeating truths or rumors. And he did it for a class. Like he did it for a class and got a 90. A 90% on this project that really sort of like, you know, screwed up some people's lives and managed to like distribute a lot of misinformation. And I just think it's so fascinating. Like when 1984 was written, they could not, like Orwell could not have imagined just how simple it would be to alter the truth these days. And there's something very exciting and terrifying about that power being in everyone's hands.
To me, that illustrates the kind of journalism state that we're in right now, where most of the time, especially in an industry like video game reporting, where it's just about breaking the news first, where when the news breaks, everyone just wants to jump on it immediately and get it out on their blog. And they don't often go through the proper channels of fact-checking something. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that that happened. And I feel like that happens. I mean, we've seen that happen with much more serious mm-hmm. affairs, you know, death, people thinking that some celebrity is dead because they right. saw it reported one place and then yeah. it travels. So, yeah. I wonder why he didn't get 100% on this, on this assignment. Come on.
Because the assignment was
extra
to
credit.
Go viral, right? So the assignment was merely to go viral, but, you know, the thing I think where maybe the instructor, speaking as someone who has yeah. to evaluate this kind of stuff, maybe had a certain level of pause around this was just sort of the assignment was not to fabricate, an entire world in order to go viral or to fabricate or to mess with the truth in order yeah. to do that. I mean, I could have probably figured out a way to post a cat video and made it go viral without having to manufacture an entire and complicated sort of corporate fraud.
Yeah.
That's big talk, Karen. Let's see those cat videos.
Right? Let's see a cat video right now.
My cat meow. Has scratched meow. Records to Les Mis, so
get
I'm pretty sure
it.
I could go viral.
All right, winner, what are you all about?
Well, I'm all about all you haters not being on the Cobain train.
I'm with you, girl. I am with you.
I am in love with him and his legend and his spirit. And I saw a montage of Heck this morning, and it was really beautiful, well put together documentary. I mean, this was produced by Courtney and Frances Bean, his daughter. Obviously, there's a little bit of a slant there. Dave Grohl's not in it, which bums me the hell out. But then I read this morning that he's...
They don't get along.
Right? Yeah. They didn't get along. Well, him and Courtney don't really get along, but I guess him and Kurt didn't really get along either. Mm-hmm. But it was a beautiful story. It was almost kind of heart-wrenching, like watching Titanic, because you know what's coming. But Kurt Cobain was such a complicated man, person, child. The love that he lacked from his father fueled pretty much everything. They interviewed his father.
And then at the end, Courtney throws his reputation into the ocean.
Oh, no, no. She actually, no. I mean, I was waiting for it, but she actually pulled it together for this. She looked great. She told great stories. It was really raw. I mean, the video, the footage they have is like a lot of the Reading Festival's in there. There's a lot of interviews and archive stuff from MTV and Kurt's own actual home videos, the Super 8s that he was growing up with, the home movies, his audio tapes. The audio was laid over with really beautiful animation. So Brent Morgan put all of this together and edited it. And it was just, for a person like me, I'm such a huge fan. And he meant so much to me because I was a black girl and a preteen and struggling to sort of find my identity. Living in San Francisco, I felt like a kinship with someone that I love listening to all the time. But they were saying exactly what I was feeling. That's kind of why I have this connection with him. So I cried. Cried pretty much the entire time. It's also the only probably Nirvana concert I'll ever get. It was so loud and the sound was amazing. Ooh. And they showed tons of performances and the music is thumping. So it's probably the only, you know, actual presentation personally that I'll have from Kurt beyond his music. So sorry to get all sentimental about it, but it was a very emotional experience.
Well, I'm really
for me.
Curious about what it was like to hear some of his personal cassettes or like the kind of mix, the tapes he recorded, I guess, on his own at home.
Yeah. He actually reminded me of like the first boyfriend I had, because I understood why I was so in love with that dude. It's because he's very philosophical and interesting and weird and introspective and kind of self-loathing, but like also weird. I love weird dudes who are very creative and very passionate about what they believe in. And he was very confident in a couple of things. And one of them was music, and you felt it when you listened to every single song. So that's why.
Like already he had this kind of self-possessed gift that he was aware of.
Yeah, so everything that he said on the tapes was very much like, I'm just being myself. I'm going to rock this out. I'm still being myself. And he's saying different things, and his poetry was very, he was much more of a writer than a sort of, you know, he sang and then he wrote. And I feel like he was committed to that. The heroin stuff was hard to watch.
Yeah.
Karen. What are you all about this week?
Well, I mean, actually, I wonder what it would have been like if Kurt Cobain had grown old, right?
You know? I think about it all the time. He would have lived in Malibu and been, like, friends with Johnny Depp. Yeah.
Well, and this is where...
or he would have just gone back up to the Pacific Northwest and been like, no thanks.
No thanks.
Yeah, well, this is where, you know, the thing that I'm all about this week is a film called While We're Young, about Gen Xers who've grown up, mm-hmm. who are in their mid-40s, and who have... And it's interesting because it's a midlife crisis film, but not about just one guy, but a couple who suffers through it together, a couple who doesn't have kids, and they sort of glom onto or start to feel invigorated by a 20-something couple in New York, and they're all part of this kind of creative class, cinephilic scene, and you see all sorts of hilarity ensues, really. Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts are the 40-something couple, and Adam Driver and Amanda Seyfried, I think that's how you pronounce her name,
very good.
Are the 20-something couple. And the first two-thirds of it are really kind of genius insofar as you see these 40-somethings start to sort of fetishize how, I think at one point Naomi Watts says, they took everything we threw out and brought it back and made it beautiful. So things like records, actual printed matter, like books, you know, reading an actual newspaper, and then it kind of intercuts with scenes of the 40-somethings on their iPhones, on their iPads, you know, constantly looking things up on Google instead of, you know, figuring it out.
The present moment, yeah.
Yeah, and even the music, the music was kind of genius in the earlier part of it, because you see that Adam Driver's always playing records, and it's funny because he like basically resuscitates these songs that were pop songs at the time, and they become cool again in the ears of Ben Stiller, right? So like, you know, All Night Long, Get Out of My Dreams and Into My Car, Ghosting You by Psychedelic Furs.
Oh man, this sounds good.
Karen, 2 points. The first one is I just watched a BuzzFeed video of like high school students listening to music from the 90s.
Oh, yes.
And their universal consensus. Ugh. Some of the songs confused them. Some of them they liked. The universal consensus that Tub Thumping is an amazing song.
Blew my mind.
God.
It was wonderful.
Those kids need help.
Yes.
Karen, you said something really interesting. You said the first two thirds, and I think it is very true of like smart, purposey comedies that they cannot, in almost every case, cannot hold together that last act. Does anyone have any thoughts or theories on it?
I think it's pushing towards a sort of redemptive message. I think that that's what ends up happening is that the idea that someone has to emerge a victor in this kind of conflict, right? And so it does, I think, you know, I'm not going to spoil anything, but it does end up redeeming a certain values of someone who belongs to the older generation to a certain extent and you know, and punishes, rightfully so, millennials for harnessing authenticity in order to get ahead and not just for the sake of, you know, not just for the love of these objects or these things. That's what turned the older couple on to begin with about this pair.
But I think it's also curiosity and discovery, right? Like that's what we were all doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was 15, I was into like 50s, 60s music. So I'm sure like it's the same way for those millennials.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think so. But you know, I think that with the final third, again, I think it's because, you know, someone has to emerge as a hero or that there has to be some sort of message.
Yeah. There has to be some sort of like moral story, moral end.
That's a really interesting point because my mind always goes to like Tootsie or, I mean, Mean Girls particularly is really trying to sort of like take everyone through therapy about like bullying and stuff, and it's tiresome. We don't want to watch that. We want to see awesome people be awesome and dance to All I Want for Christmas Is You. Margaret, what are you all about this week?
Well, I'm still very high from the whole experience of the LA Times Festival of Books because I feel like that is my geeky Comic-Con time of the year. It's my Coachella. Mm-hmm. There's less, you know, body glitter and so forth, but
Face paint. More face paint and finger paint.
Margaret, let's go shopping for Margaret Atwood cosplay wigs. As
there
frizzy and red as you can.
Exactly. Lots of frizz tied to the skull, and we will go and rock the festival next year. But yeah, I mean, it just reinvigorates my love for books. And I was moderating a panel with 4 short story writers on it, and it was just a really great discussion. And, you know, short stories in particular are hard to get published and hard to find an audience for. And so being part of something like that reminds me again that, like, at the end of the day, we should all just do what we love for the love of the thing and not necessarily worry about, like, how it's going to be received or what kind of money you'll get for it and all of that. It's just for the love. And so the Festival of Books always reminds me of that.
I feel like L.A. being a place where people can make very good livings off of creativity kind of destroys everyone's approach to creativity because even writers, like performers of every kind, are just thinking about monetization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's why sometimes I love to go to other cities and see their art scene, see what they're doing, because I feel like when you're in L.A. or New York and to a certain extent like Chicago and Seattle, but you know, particularly New York and L.A., it is so, like, it is a job. It is a career. And a lot of times that does compromise something in terms of what people are willing to do and what they're willing to experiment with and try out. And so, I feel like in L.A. in particular, like, we're all kind of constantly aware of, like, who has agents and who has deals and who has...
There's also, like, options paralysis. Just too many opportunities and options to be had. And everybody trying to sort of grab them all for themselves.
And scenes and sub-scenes. But LA Times, I think the Festival of Books does a good job of you know, bringing people in who aren't going to, you know, sell. I mean, they bring academics in, for example.
They do.
To come and chat about, about 30 people read our books, right? So,
but why do they time it during Coachella? I find that so obnoxious.
You know, it hasn't always been like that, but it has been
for the past few years.
Karen, all academics in the greater Los Angeles basin are compromised because all of you guys are consultants on some TV show.
Well, somebody show me the money. I don't have a gig yet.
Right, we need to get Karen a consultant gig.
Which I think, okay, but just really quickly, I need a consultant gig with Grey's Anatomy now that, spoiler alert,
right.
This is what I've actually been all about for the last 24 hours. My dear beloved Dr. Derek Shepherd is no more.
R.I.P.
Why did they kill this man? I mean, isn't he leaving the show?
No, he's leaving.
I thought he had just signed some kind of contract.
He did, a two-year contract. He signed a two-year, so he finished 1 year of the two-year contract. But I guess that...
Oh, I didn't know that.
But the story I read is that just
now you feel betrayed. Right?
Yeah, now I feel betrayed.
Right?
Yeah.
But he's so into his car racing, apparently, that like heralded not only the end of his appearance on the show, but it's one of the reasons he's getting divorced. I just read that this morning because I was like, oh, what do I do?
Wait a second, he's so into car racing that it severed his marriage?
That's what one article purported.
Unbelievable.
Today, so
men, get it together.
Get a life.
Was this McSteamy or McDreamy?
McDreamy.
McSteamy died years ago.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That was McSteamy.
McSteamy's like,
I mean, three deaths ago.
At this point, it's pretty much just like Sandra Oh and a scalpel, right? Like, there's nobody left on that.
Sandra Oh is gone.
I know, Guy. I also was like, she's still on it, right?
No. It's Meredith Grey. I mean, the person who the show is named after is still the lead character.
She's going to be on it for a long time.
But, you know...
No one has ever in her life cared about Ellen Pompeo. Like
I totally have cared about Ellen Pompeo. Of course I have. And I want to write, like, after Derek Shepherd, you know, Meredith Grey's latter-day lesbianism.
Yeah, I can see that happening.
Let's hope that it goes there.
If it goes there,
then all is forgiven.
I give it 2 seasons before she gets in bed with a chick. I'm just letting you know right now.
Well, Arizona's still single on the show right now, so who knows what's going
on. Arizona's one season.
Yeah.
You guys, this is not a Grey's Anatomy recap show.
It can be a scandal recap show
if we all agree, but I will not allow it to be Grey's Anatomy. Okay. All right, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Julie Sabatier, host of Rendered, a show about making meaning and breaking rules. Tune in to hear how learning to butcher could change your life, why turning to the internet for health advice is sometimes a good idea, and what happens when artists are really honest.
I mean, I think of most of my career in music and art as a bunch of failures, you know?
So what keeps you going with it, then? Check out Rendered now at MaximumFun.org or wherever you like to listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. Over in our LA studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Karen Tongson.
Margaret Wappler.
And this week, we're going to talk about living in a world where you can get all of the information that you want about things and how to deal with living in this world of too much information. As part of the Sony hack, we found out that Ben Affleck was part of a television series that Henry Louis Gates was doing about ancestry in America, and he found out that Ben Affleck had slave-owning ancestors. Ben did everything in his power to keep that from being in the series, even though many other high-profile people, like Anderson Cooper, had slave owners in their family history who they talked about. At the same time, as part of the Sony leak, we've gotten to go through all of Amy Pascal's deepest, darkest consumer purchases, her list of plans for plastic surgery, and an Amazon purchase list that included dye for her pubic hair,
terrible.
A lot of Diva Curl products.
Feminine products.
And basically, my question is, we've basically been going through a lot of scandals and difficulties with this access to information, and that Ben Affleck's attempt to sort of like control and produce his presentation is a thing that really isn't that possible anymore. And like, how should we be approaching things at a point in time where privacy doesn't really exist anymore?
I think it's different to kind of consider the case of Ben Affleck trying to repress this information in the context of a show about genealogy that, that Henry Louis Gates, kind of one of the most prominent African-Americanist scholars, it was producing, right? Because it's less that he's trying to repress, you know, like what he bought for dinner, where his daughters go to school, but something that's like an important part of, you know, American history that we're all culpable for, that we are all complicit with, even now in the contemporary moment. And so, yeah, as you said, there were plenty of other stars featured on the show who had ancestors who were slave owners. And I think that what maybe Affleck didn't get was that this wasn't so much an invasion of privacy, but I think a part of, in my opinion, a part of understanding the way race works in America, a part of the legacy of slavery that perpetuates into the contemporary moment, and that I think that it was a little bit shady to try to dampen that information or to not, to try to use his influence to repress that information.
Well, it's fascinating because we treat slavery and sort of like race in America as this artifact from the past that has no link to us. Mm-hmm. And it's hard because we live in a time now where we have, no one wants to be a racist. No one wants to be attached to racism as it exists. No white person does, but at the same time we are. And like this separation allows us the fiction that we are not complicit in the racism that's going on today, that we're these other better people. I always like to take it back to The Help. We want to say that we are Emma Stones, not Bryce Dallas Howards. Yeah. And the thing is like my grandmother's grandfather owned slaves. That is a terrible, terrible, horrible thing to know. But also, we need to remember, it's not like nobody owned those slaves. It's a thing that happened. Like, our country exists because of tax dollars that we got from people who were treated as property.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that when I read Ben Affleck's statement that he put up on Facebook, I do think that was an honest statement. I think he was embarrassed. I think what he said about feeling embarrassed is 100% true. And I understand it because, like you, I know that I also have slave owning relatives in my past. Like, my family goes way back in Alabama. And I mean, I've never bothered to do the genealogy, but, you know, I mean, the chances are. And I, you know, it's not something that is fun to confront. It's hard to think about. And it's hard, particularly when you think about someone like Ben Affleck, who has taken great care to control his image, and especially as a type of philanthropist and a type of do-gooder. And I think, you know, as much as we are tied to our family, we're also not our family. We're also not responsible for things that happened in the past, but yet we are tied to it. So it's like how to navigate that, right? Like how to deal with that. And I think he could have taken it and owned it as an opportunity to talk about those uncomfortable feelings, but he just chickened out, you know? He just lost his nerve.
Which is apparently what Anderson Cooper did, is that, you know, when he was confronted with this information, he engaged it honestly with a kind of surprise, with the opportunity to really reflect on what that means or how that affects our own relationship to the contemporary moment and how we're all complicit with this structure, as you were saying, Guy, that was heinous and evil, but that continues in the different systems of racist oppression today.
Well, I mean, look, I can speak unequivocally for sure. There were slaves in like four generations back. My great-great-grandmother was a slave. My great-grandmother worked on the tail end of a sharecropping plantation. If you understand the fabric of America, as you guys have all said much more eloquently, then you understand that this existed. Mm-hmm. I am biased. I'm in love with Ben Affleck. I have been since I was 9 years old. I have the biggest crush on him, and I just think everything he does is amazing, and that's just my movie star crush. I, like, literally am in love with him. So I'm giving him not a pass. I'm disappointed that he is being as for my people as he's been. He went through that, even though she's Hispanic, he was with J-Lo, and that was, like, a whole, you know, walk on the wild side for somebody like him. But I know in his heart that he was trying to do what he felt was like the right thing because it was a snap judgment. I think he was like, well, we can't have that out there because, I mean, I can't endure any more hate. And if we cannot have it, we can't have it. But if he did it in such a way that he's not addressing the reality and he's just pretending like it doesn't happen, that would be weird to me.
His response was, as Margaret said, really heartfelt and great. I think that actually a lot of responsibility lies with someone like Skip Gates, mm-hmm. who is a scholar and who should have never, ever, like, kind of...
I don't know why he emailed Michael Linton, that, of all know? People.
Yeah,
like,
it's exactly.
So strange. Like, but why
who
Michael
is Michael
Linton?
Linton?
He's the CEO, or he's the chairman.
Yeah, Sony exec.
Sony.
To get an opinion about all this from. And
Michael Linton was like, just bury it. He's a megastar. And I was like, really?
And I was like, but his Skip Gates' initial response in his emails was pretty much correct. Like, I don't feel comfortable doing something like this. It would compromise the integrity of the show and the project, right? But he bowed to, I guess, you know, sometimes when academics get into, you know,
he's a celebrity academic booking celebrities for a show, it's going to happen. Yeah. You're going to get people's publicists elbowing you.
Mm-hmm. Right. And apparently it was like one distant relative and not necessarily his like great great grandfather or something. I don't know. Not that that necessarily makes it better, but just. I could see how, like, the in your process of thinking about it, you're like, whatever. There's so many other people to talk about.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I wonder if Henry Louis Gates could have talked him through how to talk about it.
Why didn't he do that? If he didn't do that, he should have totally taken that moment to educate. I know sometimes, old school black folks don't feel like they have to explain anything to anybody, but I feel like this was a teachable moment, where he could have said, listen, even if he doesn't understand the context, the shady context of being a celebrity at that level, he could have found a way to work in a diversity, have like a, you know, a diversity lesson and explain, this is how, if you approach it this way, you know, address it like this way, or get in front of it, post about it on Facebook, or start, you know, something. He could have gotten in front of this, I think.
People don't always feel empowered. Even someone like Henry Louis Gates, you don't always feel empowered to do that when you're dealing with a celebrity. I had a situation where somebody like said something publicly that I had a problem with, and I like snarked about it on Twitter. And the person who is pretty famous came back and said, you have my email. Why did you not did you not talk to me about this? And it was a situation that this was someone who I communicated with enough that I should have felt capable of doing that. And I didn't, because in my head I was processing them as a celebrity.
So you think the idea of looking at, for Ben Affleck, was just as concerned about how it looked to him as it looked from the outside looking in, and then vice versa. So he was really worried about the blowback he would get. And I don't even think the blowback now is that much. I think people genuinely can look back and see that Ben has been a champion for people of all colors and a really, you know, a left wing, you know, crazy person, as they call all of us liberals. But, you know, he's been very vocal and he's been a huge proponent of it. So I'm just, you know, he was there for Obama the entire time. And
what makes it okay then, though, to tear apart Amy Pascal? I mean, you know, I don't think it's okay, but I think that, you know, there's a way in which we can forgive Ben Affleck.
Well,
for being
I actually think, like, Ben Affleck speaks to the point that you can no longer have an identity as controlled and sanitized as when he started being a celebrity. I feel like what happened with Trevor Noah a couple of weeks ago really indicates the way that, like, you... Like, he was vetted so hard by Comedy Central, and there was still some random stuff that got out. Like, we live in a time where you can't be above humanity, if that makes any sense.
Though, I mean, I'm a little uncomfortable with this idea that just because you're a celebrity, you just have no privacy. Like, you get to have no secrets. You get to, at the same time, I can see an argument for, like, Ben Affleck just wanting to process that whole thing on his own.
True.
I mean,
true.
We don't have to tell everything about our lives.
But
we
there is
don't.
Also that privilege that you are allowed to have. If the email hadn't been read or mined by whomever mined it and surfaced it, we would have never known that this would happen. How important is it for someone of his stature to, in this time in our culture, it would be for him to step up and say, he's done it now because it came out,
I wish he had, but at the same time, I can see the argument for, like, any of us, if we have something in our past that is unsavory, that we feel shame about, that we don't want to look at in the public eye. I think that we do have the right to say, I'm going to put up a boundary here. I don't have to talk about this.
Okay, so speaking of destroying all boundaries, let's get to the Amy Pascal stuff and the fact that Jezebel, like the blog that's supposed to be about feminism and like not like objectifying and ridiculing women about their bodies, went through a list of like her personal like bodily care items to tear apart who Amy Pascal is.
That was so nasty. And she knows who she is because she knows who wrote it. Should be ashamed of herself. Honestly, that was not necessary. I don't think we needed that, especially from Jezebel. I thought they were better about stuff like that.
Yeah, the whole
need for clickbait is aggressive.
Yeah, the whole blog post was sort of pitched as this like, isn't she incredible? There was a strange tone to it that seemed to me to be like rationalizing almost, like the writer felt uncomfortable about it. And so she sort of took this tact that was like, I'm praising Amy Pascal. I'm saying it's, you know, I don't know. It was a very strange post.
It was an elaborate idea.
Yeah, that she should be, based on this shopping list, you know, she should be a Halloween costume or icon for all, all gay men in West Hollywood or whatever, right? There was some sort of framing like that, which also, like, again, in a kind of gross way implicates, queer people in, you know, making it okay to be cruel to women and older women in particular for the things that they have to deal with and go through and, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's gone too far, you know? Like, Amy Pascal, like, she deserved what she got for writing some, you know, emails that were problematic in a corporate context. But then to, like, go into her personal shopping list and her, you know, letter to her, like, diet counselor, whoever it was, like, why do we need to see that as a society? Why do we need to look at that?
So it was a letter to a personal trainer basically detailing her battles with weight and drugs over time. And it's so interesting to me that we used to remove power from this woman who had gotten to the top of a very difficult field. The things that we use to debase her are her body. It's almost reminiscent of the way, like, we always use weight and body issues to go after Oprah because she's untouchable in other ways. And there's something so deeply anti-feminist about pointing and cackling about this woman having real human issues alongside being very successful and very powerful in her field.
But the letter was like something out of a diary. It was so personal. And it was
like she wrote it for herself.
She wrote it for herself. Yeah. But by the way, I hate to say it, Amy, but it was one of the best pieces produced by Sony in years. I would watch this movie about her life. Her life sounds fascinating, but it also sounds like something I can identify with. I think other women can identify with, starting so young, worried and concerned about, to the point where you're comparing yourself to your toddler sister. Like, you that identity, that struggle with your identity starting that young. I mean, this woman has been going, she's 56. I didn't even, when I saw that,
through that list of diets.
Yeah.
Hoping that the fad diets I had been on would be there. Like, it was just, did she ever try Fat Flush? Fat Flush worked well, so well for me.
Fat Flush
I
was
totally
in there.
Tried Fat Flush.
But she tried every single freaking diet. This woman, oh my God, my heart breaks for her. And my heart breaks for her.
The really interesting irony of all of this stuff is, like, I was very assertive before that I thought some of the race stuff that she was pilloried for was the sort of thing that goes on with great frequency, but we just don't see. Mm-hmm. And all of this physical stuff is even more obviously, it is more obviously hypocritical finger pointing. And how are we going to learn the lesson that this can turn on any of us very quickly?
Yeah.
I want to ask you guys a question about gender with all of this. Like, if this was a male exec and his shopping list was outed and it was filled with, you know, Rogaine hair plugs for men and other signs of insecurity about his image, I mean, would it have been talked about as much?
Definitely not. I mean, no. I think not. And I think the thing that I was going to say in response to this, too, is just that there is no more vulnerable subject in the public view than a woman of a certain age.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And this is what makes me terrified about how the next election cycle is going to go.
Oh, God, I know.
You know, with Hillary as a candidate and that kind of thing.
There's already been like, well, she's past menopause, so that means she's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. She could just press the button at any moment, depending on, you know, whether she's had enough hormones for the month. But I do think that there's a way in which it's very easy for the press, the public, to demonize older women and to view them as the kind of the saddest, most abject, to kind of consign them to those roles of like, whereas, you know, somebody who, like, if it were a male exec who was buying Rogaine and Viagra, it would just be, you know, oh, well, of course, mm-hmm. this is typical.
Right.
That's what a guy of his age who's has to be up and ready and at him to go after the 26-year-olds that he's usually dating
right.
has to do. But it's painted as tragedy when it's a woman who's
inhabiting that role. But a woman in her role in this industry couldn't speak openly about those things. Everything, I mean, I worked for agents that were power, you know, quote unquote bitches like her, and their requirement to be on their A game was something that they folded into this, you know, all of the corporate what's the word I'm looking for? Just, you know, going into the boardroom every day, dealing with guys. They were folding in feminine things that they wouldn't put on their calendars. That's always I've always thought was interesting. Like, mm-hmm. if they were going to get a blowout at lunch. It wasn't a blowout. It was lunch. You know what I mean? Like, if they were going to do it, I always found that fascinating. I was like, well, just tell them you're going to get a blowout. I mean, you're going to get a blowout. And I think that's interesting just for me because I'm always so controlling. It's weird that I would just put blowout and manicure after that. But
well, it's also a very LA thing
yes.
that these women kind of can't look like women who are in their 50s or 60s.
Right.
It's every woman's job in LA to have her ass kind of hanging out at all times and, you know, look fuckable. Like we,
yes.
Did you guys see the yes. Amy Schumer show
yes.
last fuckable
oh
day
my
video?
God.
The
yeah.
best
so
skit
good.
I've ever yeah. fucking seen.
Amazing.
Oh
so
my
good.
God.
She's on fire. Like,
yeah. And to people who don't work here or live here, they may not understand the way that like that extends to executives and agents, that they are all sort of supposed to be on point in that way, and it's not just like a publishing lady who can have a gigantic triangle of hair and make good choices about books.
You know, I was going to bring that up though, that it does,
or an academic.
It does, you know, if an executive is freaking out like this, what are the actresses like?
Oh, no,
you know?
No, no,
they're
no, no.
Going
that's what
insane.
I thought. They're going like, insane.
Their shopping list would be triple this. Like, it's, you know, it definitely sheds this light on the whole industry at large that somebody who is just taking meetings as an executive has to, you know, feels like she has to be on her game, look ageless.
Okay, I have a question for you guys. There was a point in time when Upworthy titles on Facebook would make all of us click. Every time there was a, and then you won't believe what happened, we all clicked
right.
and we all fell for it. And then collectively, we all got too savvy and moved along. Will outrage culture, will escándalo culture, will we mature past this like clickbaity hypocrisy?
I think that one interesting thing that's happening with all of this is that we are discovering that we are all crazy and we all are a mess and we all have things that we don't want other people to know about us. And in a way, it makes us, I think, I'm hoping that makes us all more compassionate to each other. I mean, I
yeah.
did feel true compassion for Amy Pascal when I saw mm-hmm. those lists and when I saw that letter. It's like, that's a real person in there. She's not just this shell executive, robot executive. Like, this is a human being.
Does not a power Jewess bleed?
Does she?
I think that until we see a celebrity give birth and see the crown, that will be the boundary.
If he had a Coke that you were drinking, you would
have
spilled
it
out
the computer.
Winter, you are some sort of terrible pop culture oracle that went from being something I couldn't imagine to something I could see OK Magazine paying $1 million for.
I'm just saying.
I mean, there's tweeting of the births.
Tweeting
Erica
of the birth.
Badu
it's coming.
That, like,
it's coming. It's imminent. Crowning.
Karen.
Yeah,
crowning,
I mean,
next thing.
Yeah, it's crowning.
Pay per view.
I'm just so
it's
stunned.
It's what's for
by,
dinner.
I'm so stunned
it's
by
the new pork.
Exactly.
Yeah.
By pay per view crowning that I can't even compose any thoughts in response. I don't even remember your question anymore. because I'm trying to imagine who.
Have you eaten placenta? That's
the question. Yes, have you eaten placenta lately?
Start a pool of Winter, who the first celebrity to do this is going to be, you know?
Winter, you terrified Karen Tonkson with thoughts of the vagina. That's impressive work.
I'm good, right? I'm good. Am I good?
No babies.
You guys,
no
you're
babies.
Listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
I listen to Bullseye for the moment when Jesse asks an artist an insightful question and the artist goes, oh, huh, and pauses. And you can hear in the pause that he is reassessing his own work in light of the question that Jesse just asked.
Bullseye is your guide to what's good from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio. Well, not in the studio. I'm not in the studio. But who's in the studio?
Winter Mitchell.
Karen Tonkson.
Margaret Wappler.
And you guys, every week on this show, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Margaret, what's your jam?
This week, it is J. Cole's Wet Dreams, partially Ooh. In I know, sexy tones, partially in honor of, like, the confession mode that this show has been in, although this is a voluntary confession and not one that was just taken from him by email. But this is J. Cole from his new, it's not that new anymore, but it came out in December, from his album 2014, Forest Hills Drive, and this is him talking about his first time.
It wasn't nothing like that first time. She was in my math class. Long hair, brown skin with a fat ass. Sat beside me, used to laugh, had mad jokes. The teacher always got mad, so we passed notes. It started off so innocent. She had a vibe and a nigga started digging it. I was a young and straight crushing, trying to play this shit cool. But a nigga couldn't wait to get to school. Cause when I seen them thighs on her and them hips on her and them lips on her, got me daydreaming, man, what? I'm thinking how she rides on it, if she sits on it, if she licks on it, make it hard for me to stand up as time goes by.
Oh my.
Right?
That's adorable.
I know. And it keeps going and it's really great. And I love J. Cole. He's one of my crushes. I think he's so charismatic in an easygoing way that isn't like he has to yell about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's just got it. He's got it down.
He's not Yeezus.
Winner, what's your jam?
Mine is In Bloom by Nirvana. And this song in particular was my favorite because this is the song where I thought he was going to pull it together because he was always – the video came out for this quite some time, almost closer to In Utero. But the video came out for this, and the video is really crazy and like sort of set in like a 50s Ed Sullivan-ish type feel, and they go crazy off the rock at the end. Yeah, it's a great video. But this is where I knew at the same time he was going to be – catapulted into like infamy, but this is where he was starting to, it was starting to piss him off. So I love this song and I sing it at karaoke. It's one of my top five Ooh. Karaoke songs. I love this song.
I look so
Look at
serious.
Guy, he's over it. I love this song.
Even I know this song.
Guy's like, why are you torturing me?
We definitely have to do karaoke together.
His voice is
so... This is low, though. How do you do karaoke to this?
I can sing. And I get down in there, it's just like I'm drunk, you know? Look at you, Guy.
Yeah, guy, get your flannel on. Get your flannel on your beanie, girl.
I love this song. I miss you, Kurt. Come back to us somehow.
Karen Tonkson, what is your jam this week?
Well, okay, so my jam is another kind of trashy radio hit, and it's Natalie LaRose featuring Jeremy, and it's Somebody, which samples...
Jeremiah?
Oh, yeah. my. Well, in any case, It samples I Want to Dance with Somebody by Whitney Houston. Aww. And one of the reasons that...
Good jam.
One of the reasons...
You caught my attention.
Well, it's evocative of, and it also has an opening riff that's also evocative of the New Shoes, I Can't Wait.
I love that song. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and the reason I chose it actually is somewhat incongruous, and it's because it reminds me of my grandmother. My grandmother, who just passed away recently, and who was a wonderful and ebullient party person, and she moved to the States around the time that Whitney's I Want to Dance with Somebody came out. So it always kind of makes me think of her first arriving, dancing around to that tune whenever it came on her car stereo, her red Ford Escort, the grandma mobile.
That's such a grandma car, yeah.
And she also, the part that most reminds me of her is the little part after Jeremiah says, I want to take shots with somebody, and you hear, shut. Because
I love that reminds you of your grandmother.
Well,
mine too.
At her 70th birthday, at every birthday actually, up until this last one, there was always this tradition where she would get a bottle of Patron out and tell everybody to take shot.
Oh, I love that.
So, she really was a party person.
Without further ado, this is, for my grandmother, whose afterlife radiates in the strangest of places.
Natalie LaRose.
Yeah.
I wanna rock with somebody.
Yeah.
Do I hear this
I wanna
all the
take
time?
Shots with somebody.
Shots.
That is love when you can take shots together.
Yes. That's love.
And we ain't gotta tell nobody. We ain't gotta tell nobody.
That is love.
Everybody know what's good. But some gon' hate what's
They were just on the Ellen Show together, I think.
They were?
I can see that. Ellen probably loves this song. He's singing it in the shower.
That was nice, not quite enough energy for my taste.
Karen. Oops.
It's a song dedicated to an old lady who died at the age of 80.
Thumbs down from Guy. He's this guy.
All right, I respect. I'm sorry, I'm so critical. All right, you guys. Let me set the stage for my jam, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, do
so
it.
So this week we were directly halfway through the season on RuPaul's Drag Race. But in an amazing twist, they brought back all of the former competitors, and we're going to do one of those classic reality TV, like all of the people who have gotten fired from the show have a chance to get back on the show. But it was by runwaying with one of the current competitors as conjoined twins. So,
wow.
Like amazing, amazing high level drag. And when we got down to the two final, the two people who were on the bottom, who were gonna have to lip sync for their lives, I thought to myself, they could never do it, but wouldn't it be amazing if they had these queens have to lip sync together as conjoined twins? And then what happened? They did it. One pair of queens were conjoined genitals to back. The other two were fused at the boobs.
They turned out
performances that were devastating and amazing to the following song.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they say. We're together. I watch how you play. They don't understand.
Tiff, Tiff.
So
perennial.
I think we need to chase this with some Samantha Fox. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I want to have some fun.
Sorry, I just talked up your song, Guy.
It's okay. We just need to get to it. Okay. So, all I'm saying is that a relatively lackluster season of Drag Race was suddenly raised to the greatest of heights. Karen, I am again urging you to get caught up on the show and come back near the end, because I want to have a conversation with Margaret and Winter about women and drag and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I just noticed it's on Hulu now that Derek Shepherd's dead. I can watch.
Yep. Some time has opened up.
Yeah.
Give us a free slot. Free slot. Yeah. That queue just got lighter.
Yeah.
Get to work, ladies. I need you to be up to date, or at least versed in Drag Race in a couple of weeks so we can have a proper conversation.
Got it.
Absolutely.
All right, ladies. And finally, before we go, he's not here to plug it, but we love Oliver Wang. And his new book, Legions of Boom, just came out. And you can find out all about it at legionsofboom.com. We'll put that link up along with all of our current jams on our own page at MaximumFun.org. Hey, guys, what have they been listening to?
Pop Rocket!
Hosted by me, Guy Branum, with...
Oh, my God. We just did that. Winter Mitchell.
Karen Tongson.
Margaret Wappler.
And the spirit of Oliver Wang. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Totoro SLP, the world's greatest pizza party. Hello.
Yeah.
Lots of eights. Oh, well. Evelyn Ann. Evelyn Ann. Dan MS823. Ashley Popper. Audra Jude. Monty Kins. Jaden814. MP Sweeney. Jen Grizzly. And El Paso Goose. For the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If MP Sweeney is Mike Sweeney, thank you so much and I love you. If you haven't already, please review us. It lets us know that you care. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. We own our own Twitter name now.
Yeah.
Join the Pop Rocket Podcast Face group. This week, tell us about a piece of culture much beloved by your peers that you are just not into. You guys, we are a production of MaximumFun.org. And our producer is the very handsome Colin Anderson.
Yeah.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.